Welcome back to another deep dive. This time we're looking at an issue of the 802 Ed that's seriously packed with useful stuff.
Yeah, especially for anyone involved in Vermont education.
Absolutely. We're talking about how to keep great teachers around.
That's always a hot topic.
It really is. And then we've got the never-ending saga of education funding.
Ugh, don't get me started.
And of course, we can't forget about the very real concerns about kids' mental health these days.
It's a lot to unpack, but this issue really digs into it all.
It does. And of course, the editor always has something to say about how politics ties into everything.
He always does. So where do you want to start?
Well, that Harvard Business Review article really caught my eye. It talks about this concept of anti-mattering, which I thought was fascinating.
Oh, yeah, that was a good one. Have you ever felt like your work just doesn't make a difference?
Oh, absolutely. I think everyone has those days where you're just like, what's the point?
Right, but imagine feeling that way in a job as important as teaching.
No wonder so many teachers are burning out.
Exactly. And the article makes a strong case that this anti-mattering feeling is a huge factor in teacher retention.
So what can we actually do about it? They have some suggestions, right?
They do. They lay out three main strategies that school leaders can use to combat this feeling.
Okay, I'm all ears.
The first one is pretty straightforward: show appreciation. And I don't just mean a pizza party once a year.
Yeah, I was going to say, pizza parties only go so far.
It's more about creating a culture of appreciation where teachers and staff feel valued and recognized consistently.
So it's about those everyday acknowledgments, not just grand gestures every once in a while.
Exactly. Like noticing when someone goes above and beyond and letting them know you appreciate it.
I like that. What's the second strategy?
It's all about providing opportunities for growth. So things like professional development, mentoring programs, even just encouraging teachers to share their expertise with each other.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
You don't want teachers to feel like they're stuck in a rut.
Exactly. It's about giving them the chance to learn and grow and develop their skills.
So keeping them engaged and excited about their work.
Exactly. And then the third strategy is about fostering a sense of community.
That's so important.
It really is. When teachers feel connected to their colleagues and invested in their school's mission, they're less likely to feel like their work doesn't matter.
Because they're part of something bigger than themselves?
Exactly. It's that feeling of belonging and shared purpose that can really make a difference.
Okay, so we've got appreciation, growth, and community. All good stuff. But how does this all connect to what's happening here in Vermont?
Well, that V.T. Digger piece about the governor's reappointment of the interim secretary of education is a good example of how leadership decisions can impact all of this.
Right. There's been a lot of controversy around that appointment.
There has. Some people are questioning whether an interim appointment can even be renewed legally. But beyond that, there are concerns about the lack of transparency in the process.
And whether the interim secretary has the experience to really tackle the challenges facing our schools right now.
Exactly. A lot of folks feel like the people who are actually in the trenches of education weren't given enough of a voice in this decision.
So it's not just about the legalities. It's about whether people feel confident in the leadership and direction.
And that lack of confidence can definitely contribute to that anti-mattering feeling we were talking about.
It all connected. Before we move on from school leadership, I want to touch on that quick tip from Education Week's Data Bits section.
Oh, yeah. The one about getting teachers more involved in data-driven inquiry.
Right. Why is that so important?
Because data can be really overwhelming, especially if you're just handed a giant spreadsheet and told to figure it out.
Like trying to drink from a fire hose.
Exactly. But if teachers are empowered to analyze data in smaller chunks, focused on specific areas where their students are struggling, it becomes a much more powerful tool.
So it's about making data actionable, something that teachers can actually use to improve their teaching and support their students.
It takes data from being this abstract thing to being a tool for growth and improvement.
And it shifts the focus from a top-down approach to a more collaborative one.
Exactly. Teachers feel more ownership over the data and the process.
Okay, let's shift gears now to a topic that's been weighing heavily on a lot of minds: youth mental health. That V.T. Digger article about the latest youth mental health survey was pretty alarming.
Yeah, no sugarcoating it. Things are getting worse, and not just by a little bit.
The numbers were really tough to read. We're talking about double-digit increases in feelings of sadness, hopelessness, and anxiety among Vermont middle and high schoolers.
It's a serious crisis, and it's happening right here in our own backyard.
So what can we do about it? Is there any hope on the horizon?
Well, the Guardian article we have suggests that teaching social-emotional learning early on could be a key piece of the puzzle.
Okay, social-emotional learning. I've heard that term, but could you break it down for me?
It's about giving kids the tools to understand and manage their emotions, build healthy relationships, and make responsible decisions.
So things like empathy, communication, conflict resolution, those are definitely skills that can help kids navigate the pressures of growing up.
Exactly. It's like teaching life skills alongside academics.
And the research shows that it can have long-term benefits, not just for mental health, but also for academic success and overall well-being.
Right. It's not just about feeling good, it's about setting kids up for success in all areas of their lives.
That's encouraging. It sounds like something we should be investing in here in Vermont.
I agree. Given the alarming trends in youth mental health, exploring and implementing effective social-emotional learning programs seems like a no-brainer.
Okay, speaking of things that need attention in Vermont, let's talk about the elephant in the room, education funding. We all know it's a complex issue, but can you give us a quick overview of why it's such a challenge here?
Sure. The short version is that Vermont's education funding system relies heavily on property taxes.
Which
means that schools in wealthier towns with higher property values have more resources than schools in less affluent areas.
So we've got this built-in inequity baked right into the system.
And on top of that, we have declining enrollment in many parts of the state and rising costs across the board. It's a recipe for disaster.
It really is. So how do we fix it?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. One solution, which is outlined in the 7 Days VT summary of the teachers' union proposal, is to shift away from property taxes and implement a progressive income tax dedicated to education funding.
So basically asking higher earners to contribute more to support schools.
Exactly. The idea is that it would create a more equitable system because it wouldn't be so dependent on where you live.
It makes sense in theory, but I imagine there would be a lot of pushback.
There would. Those who oppose the idea worry about the impact on higher earners and the potential for political gridlock.
It's definitely a controversial proposal.
Yeah.
But it shows how desperate people are to find a solution to this funding problem. Mm-hmm. What are some other ideas that are being thrown around?
The Chester Telegraph article talks about the Commission on the Future of Public Education. They're taking a more holistic approach, looking at everything from consolidating school districts to revising the funding formula to finding ways to increase efficiency.
So they're trying to address the problem from multiple angles.
They are. They know that there's no quick fix, so they're looking at a whole range of possibilities.
It sounds like they have their work cut out for them.
They do. And then there's the Brigham Decision Alternative No. 2, which is another attempt to address the funding disparities that were highlighted by a landmark Vermont Supreme Court ruling.
Wait, remind me what the Brigham decision was all about.
Essentially, the court ruled that all Vermont students, regardless of where they live or how wealthy their town is, deserve equal access to educational resources.
Okay, that makes sense. And Alternative No. 2 is trying to put that principle into action.
It is. It's a proposal to adjust the funding formula so that more resources are directed to schools in less affluent areas.
So it's about trying to level the playing field. But I remember reading in VT Digger that there's been some back and forth between the legislature and the governor's office on this.
Yeah, there's definitely some disagreement about the best way to move forward. Some want to phase in changes gradually, while others want to see more immediate and substantial action.
It sounds like finding common ground is going to be key.
It is. It's a delicate balance between fiscal responsibility and the need to provide equal opportunities for all students.
Speaking of finding solutions, let's take a look at what other states are doing. The Heads Up Vermont section highlights some interesting approaches that might be worth considering here.
Yeah, other states are experimenting with some pretty innovative ideas.
Like what?
Well, Massachusetts has decided to drop high-stakes testing as a graduation requirement.
Wow. That's a big move. What's the rationale behind that?
They argue that high-stakes tests put too much pressure on students and teachers, and that they often lead to a narrowing of the curriculum.
Because everyone is so focused on teaching to the test?
Exactly. They're saying we need to look at a wider range of skills and accomplishments to assess student learning.
Interesting. What about Colorado and Mississippi? They've made some changes to their funding formulas, right?
They have. Both states have adopted funding models that take individual student needs into account.
So factors like poverty level, special education status, English language learner status, all of that plays into how much funding a school receives.
Exactly. It's about recognizing that a one-size-fits-all approach to funding doesn't work for every student.
Makes sense. It'll be interesting to see if Vermont decides to borrow any of these ideas.
It will. These other states are like little laboratories of innovation.
All right, let's move on to a topic that's sadly become all too familiar: school safety. That Education Week tracker is a sobering reminder that school shootings are still a reality in our country.
It's heartbreaking. We're already at 36 school shootings so far in 2024.
And the recent incident in Memphis where a student was injured at Central High School just underscores how real this threat is.
It's a reminder that this can happen anywhere.
Even in a state like Vermont.
Exactly. We can't afford to be complacent. So it's important to remember that we do have resources in place. The Department of Public Safety and the Agency of Education jointly operate an anonymous school safety tip line.
Right, so students, staff, community members, anyone can report anything that seems concerning.
Potential threats of violence, bullying, mental health issues, anything.
You don't have to wait until something happens to report it. If you see something, say something.
Exactly. And the tip line is completely anonymous, so people can feel safe coming forward.
That's good to know. Anonymity is key. Now, before we get into the editor's always insightful commentary, I want to take a quick peek at the reader survey results from the last issue.
What are people saying?
It looks like a lot of folks are wondering what the new presidential administration might mean for education.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of uncertainty and anxiety about potential changes in education policy.
People want to know how these political changes might affect their kids' education.
It's a big question mark right now.
It is. So let's see what our editor has to say about it all.
I'm ready to hear his take.
Let's dive in.
The editor kicks things off with Thanksgiving dinner.
Ah, yes, the annual tradition of awkward political conversations.
Exactly. He talks about how his family was grappling with the election results. Some were joking about fleeing the country. Others were worried that schools would just cease to exist.
It's funny, but also kind of terrifying because it reflects the very real anxiety that a lot of people are feeling right now about the future of education.
Right. It's like this underlying fear of the unknown.
Exactly. So what are some of the specific things that people are worried about?
Well, he jumps right into this senator's bill to abolish the Department of Education.
Abolish the Department of Education?
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty radical idea. Is that even likely to happen?
Probably not, but it's definitely got people talking.
I can imagine. So what are the arguments for and against abolishing the Department of Education?
Well, those who support it say that the department is a big bloated bureaucracy that gets in the way of states and local communities making decisions about their own schools.
So it's a states' rights argument.
Exactly. They believe that education should be handled at a more local level with minimal interference from the federal government.
But what about funding? Doesn't the Department of Education distribute a lot of federal money to schools?
It does. That's one of the big concerns about abolishing it. Those who oppose the bill worry that it would undermine efforts to ensure equity and accountability in education.
So they're worried that without a federal agency overseeing these things, we could see a backslide in progress toward things like civil rights for students or protections for students with disabilities.
Exactly. They also point to the department's role in promoting access to quality education for all students, regardless of background.
And without the department, who would ensure that those things happen?
That's the big question. Some folks have suggested that federal funding could be distributed directly to states through block grants.
What?
But critics worry that without clear accountability measures, that could lead to even greater disparities between states.
So it's a really complicated issue with a lot of potential unintended consequences.
It is. And it's definitely adding to the anxiety that people are feeling right now.
Okay, so we've got this looming question of whether the Department of Education will even exist. And on top of that, there's the whole issue of the incoming president's pick for education secretary.
Ah, yes, the one with the unconventional background.
To say the least, it's not every day you see someone who used to run a professional wrestling company tapped to lead the Department of Education.
It's definitely an interesting choice.
A lot of people are questioning whether she has the qualifications for the job.
Yeah, her resume highlights her business skills and her time in the world of pro wrestling, which doesn't exactly scream education expert.
It's a pretty big leap from the wrestling ring to the helm of the Department of Education.
But to be fair, she did hold a teaching license at one point.
Did she ever actually teach in a classroom, though?
It doesn't seem like it. And she served on the State Board of Education in Connecticut for a short time, but she resigned before her term was up.
So she has some connection to education, but not the kind of deep experience you might expect from someone in this position.
It's definitely a gamble.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Some people are hopeful that her business experience and outsider perspective could be assets.
Maybe she'll shake things up and bring some fresh ideas to the table.
But others worry that her lack of experience in education policy will be a major obstacle.
Time will tell, I guess.
Speaking of waiting and seeing, the editor's Thanksgiving dinner conversation also touched on a topic that's on the minds of a lot of people, student loan forgiveness.
Ah, yes. The dream of wiping out student debt.
Is it actually going to happen under the new administration?
The editor doesn't think so.
So much for a clean slate.
He's pretty blunt about it. He says widespread student loan forgiveness is unlikely.
So anyone who was hoping for that might be disappointed.
But he does acknowledge that the new administration might explore other ways to address the issue.
Like what?
Things like income-based repayment plans or targeted forgiveness programs for people in certain professions.
So maybe not a total wipeout of debt, but potentially some relief for those who are struggling.
It's a start.
Well, on that cheerful note, let's take a step back from the political drama and look at some of the more practical things going on in the world of education.
Sounds good to me.
You mentioned earlier that the Commission on the Future of Public Education is taking a pretty comprehensive approach to addressing the education funding challenge.
Yeah, they're really trying to think outside the box.
And they released that brainstorming document from their Education Finance Subcommittee, right?
It did. It's a fascinating read. You get a real behind-the-scenes look at the kinds of things they're considering.
So what kinds of ideas are they throwing around?
Well, they've got a long list covering over 36 policy areas.
Wow, that's a lot to digest.
It is. Some of the proposals focus on tweaking the funding formula.
Okay, like how?
For example, they're looking at weighting the formula more heavily toward student needs like poverty, special education status, or English language learner status.
So basically making sure that schools with higher concentrations of students with those needs receive more funding.
Exactly. It's about recognizing that some schools face greater challenges than others and adjusting the funding accordingly.
Makes sense. What else are they looking at?
Well, some of the proposals aim to increase efficiency.
Okay, so.
They're exploring things like consolidating school districts or creating shared services between districts.
The consolidation debate. That always gets people riled up.
It's a touchy subject for sure. There are valid arguments on both sides. Those who support consolidation say it could lead to cost savings and greater efficiency.
What?
But those who oppose it worry about losing local control and the impact it could have on smaller communities.
It's a tough one. What other ideas are they brainstorming?
They're also looking at alternative ways to generate revenue.
Okay.
They're talking about revising property tax policies, exploring new taxes that would be specifically dedicated to education funding, or even considering a statewide sales tax increase.
Those are some pretty big ideas.
They are. But they know that this is a critical moment for Vermont's education system, and they're determined to find solutions that are both innovative and sustainable.
It's a daunting task. But it's encouraging to see them taking such a thorough and thoughtful approach.
I agree. Now let's turn our attention to a group that deserves more attention, students in foster care.
Oh, yes. These kids are already dealing with so much upheaval in their lives.
Yeah.
It's important that they have stability in their education.
Exactly. And the Departments of Education and Health and Human Services have put out some valuable guidance on how to create that stability.
What does the guidance say?
It emphasizes the importance of collaboration between educators, social workers, and foster families.
So it's about creating a network of support around these students.
Exactly. And ensuring that they have consistent access to the resources they need.
And minimizing school changes for these students whenever possible.
Right. Because transitions can be particularly disruptive for them.
Makes sense. What are some specific things that schools can do to support students in foster care?
The guidance suggests designating a liaison within the school to be the point person for these students, providing professional development for teachers on trauma-informed practices, and making sure students have transportation and other essential resources.
That's great. It sounds like a really comprehensive and compassionate approach.
It is. Now let's venture into the world of higher education for a moment.
Higher ed. Always an interesting topic.
There's a research paper in this issue that looks at a pre-pandemic trend in college acceptance rates.
College acceptance rates, huh?
Yeah.
Is this about how it's become so competitive to get into top-tier schools?
It is. But here's the thing. The research suggests that acceptance rates at those highly selective colleges actually started to level off and even increase a little in the years leading up to the pandemic.
Really? So it wasn't all doom and gloom for those aspiring Ivy Leaguers?
Apparently not. While it was still tough to get in, the data shows that acceptance rates weren't plummeting as dramatically as some people might have expected.
That's interesting. Any insights into why this might have happened?
The research doesn't give definitive answers, but it speculates that a few factors might have played a role, like increased outreach efforts by colleges, a greater emphasis on diversity in admissions, and a growing recognition of the importance of things beyond just test scores and grades.
So maybe colleges were starting to take a more holistic approach to admissions, looking at the whole student rather than just their academic stats.
It's possible. Now let's shift gears and talk about another piece that caught my eye, the working paper on algebra instruction.
Algebra? Okay, bring on the math.
It dives into a concerning correlation between high poverty schools and delays in starting students on the algebra track.
Delays? What do you mean?
Students in high poverty schools are often starting algebra later than their peers in more affluent areas.
Why is that?
The paper explores a number of potential reasons, including resource disparities, teacher shortages in those schools, and tracking practices that sometimes steer students in high poverty schools towards less rigorous math courses.
So we're potentially seeing systemic inequities that are creating barriers for students in low-income communities.
Exactly. And that's a big deal because algebra is often seen as a gateway course for STEM fields.
So starting it later can have a ripple effect on students' future opportunities.
It's not just about math. It's about access to a whole range of careers and pathways.
Right. This research really highlights how important it is to address these inequities and make sure that all students, regardless of their background, have access to challenging math curriculum.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Now, before we move on, I want to circle back to something we talked about earlier, the anonymous school safety tip line.
It's such a valuable resource.
It really is. And I want to make sure our listeners have all the details.
Yes, please remind us how to reach the tip line.
You can call 1-844-SAFE-OR-VT, text SAFE-OR-VT to 274-637, or submit a report online at safe4vt.org.
And it's completely anonymous.
Absolutely. So you can share your concerns without fear of retaliation.
Good to know.
Okay,
let's dive back into the political landscape. We talked about the potential for the Department of Education to be abolished, but there's another big change on the horizon, the Senator's bill, that would make public college tuition free.
Free college. That would be a game changer.
It would. What's the thinking behind this proposal?
The senator who introduced the bill argues that higher education is a public good, not just a private benefit.
So everyone should have access to it, regardless of their ability to pay.
Exactly. Yeah. He says that by making public college tuition free, we can create a more educated workforce, boost the economy, and reduce the burden of student debt.
It all sounds good, but how would pay for it?
That's the big question. The bill proposes funding it through a combination of federal and state funds, but critics say it would be incredibly expensive and potentially lead to cuts in other areas.
There are always trade-offs.
Always. But it's exciting to see bold ideas like this being put forward.
It shows that people are thinking seriously about how to make college more accessible and affordable.
I agree. Now let's turn our attention to another political development that could have a major impact on education. The recent push for increased school choice.
School choice is always a hot button issue.
It is. And there's a growing movement to expand school choice options, particularly through voucher programs and charter schools.
Can you remind me how those work?
Voucher programs give parents public funds that they can use to send their kids to private schools, while charter schools are publicly funded but operate independently of traditional public school systems.
So they offer alternatives to the traditional public school model.
Exactly. And proponents of school choice argue that it gives parents more control over their children's education and promotes competition, which they say can lead to improvements in all schools. But opponents worry that it drains resources from public schools and could exacerbate existing inequalities.
So it's a really complex issue with strong arguments on both sides.
It is. And it's clear that the debate over school choice is only going to intensify in the coming years.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground in this part of our deep dive, from anxieties about the new administration to the ins and outs of education funding and support services.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. This issue of the 802 ed has given us a lot to think about.
It really highlights the interconnectedness of education and politics.
And how decisions made at a state and national level can have a real impact on what happens in our classrooms.
So true. Well, there's still more to explore. Be sure to join us for part 3 of our deep dive, where we'll continue to unpack the latest insights from the 802 Ed.
Until then, keep those minds engaged and those deep dives going. Welcome back to our deep dive into this issue of the 802 Ed.
It's amazing how much they managed to pack into each issue.
I know, right? It's like a bottomless well of education insights.
We've already covered so much ground, too, from the anxieties about the new administration to the ins and outs of education funding and support services.
And there's still more to come. This issue also dives into some interesting pedagogical approaches.
Oh, yeah. Like what?
Well, they talk about this concept called subitizing.
Subitizing. Is that like a new math term?
It is. It's actually a cognitive skill that we use all the time, especially with young children.
Okay. I'm intrigued. Tell me more.
It's the ability to instantly recognize the number of objects in a small group without actually counting them.
So like when you see a plate of cookies and you just know there are four without having to count each one.
Exactly. The Hechinger Report article explains how this skill develops in young children and why it's so important for building a strong foundation for mathematical understanding.
It makes sense. It's like a mental shortcut for understanding quantity.
Precisely. Subitizing helps kids develop number sense, which is crucial for more complex math concepts down the road, like addition, subtraction, even multiplication.
It's amazing how such a seemingly simple skill can have such a big impact.
It really highlights how all the different areas of learning are connected.
Speaking of connections, this issue also reminds us about the importance of integrating social-emotional learning into all aspects of the curriculum.
It's not just a separate subject. It's a way of thinking about education that recognizes the importance of the whole child.
And they highlight a really cool resource for doing just that, a series of weekly videos from the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department featuring local wild animals.
I saw that. Those videos look really engaging.
They are. They're designed for students in grades K-8, and they're a fantastic way to teach kids about the natural world while also sneaking in some social-emotional learning.
So it's not just about memorizing animal facts. It's about using those observations to spark conversations about empathy, cooperation, and communication.
Exactly. Kids can watch how animals interact with each other in their environment and start to make connections to their own social and emotional experiences.
That's awesome. It's a really creative way to bring social-emotional learning to life.
It is.
Yeah.
Now let's shift gears a bit and talk about the challenge of attracting and retaining talented educators.
Oof. That's always a struggle.
It is, especially in a competitive job market. But this issue offers some good advice. They emphasize the importance of thinking outside the box when it comes to recruitment. Schools need to find ways to stand out from the crowd and showcase what makes them unique.
So instead of just posting a generic job description, they need to highlight the specific things that make their school a great place to work.
Exactly. Showcase the strengths of the community, highlight professional development opportunities, offer competitive salaries and benefits packages.
It's about making a strong case for why educators should choose to work at their school, not just any school.
Right. And they even give themselves a little pat on the back, reminding readers that the 802 ad itself can be a valuable tool for reaching potential candidates.
Smart marketing.
It is. Now, before we wrap things up, I want to take a moment to acknowledge the often overlooked heroes of our schools, the facilities workers.
The folks who keep everything running smoothly behind the scenes.
Exactly. They make sure the lights are on, the classrooms are clean, the buildings are safe. We often take their work for granted, but schools wouldn't function without them.
Absolutely. And this issue includes a chart that tracks the number of open positions for facilities workers across Vermont.
It highlights the ongoing need for skilled professionals in this area.
It's a good reminder that a thriving school requires a dedicated team of professionals in all roles, from teachers and administrators to support staff and facilities workers.
Well said. It takes a village.
This has been such a rich and informative deep dive.
It really has. I always learn so much from these conversations.
Me too. We've covered a lot of ground, from practical tips for school leaders to the latest research on student learning and the always evolving landscape of education policy.
It's amazing how much is happening in the world of education.
It really is.
Yeah.
And it's clear that the 802ED is a valuable resource for staying on top of it all.
Absolutely. They do a fantastic job of keeping us informed and engaged.
A huge thank you to the 802ED for all that they do.
Hear, hear.
And thank you for joining us on this deep dive.
It's been a pleasure.
Until next time, keep those minds engaged and those deep dives going.